the Exalt Podcast. My name is Christopher Chagnon.
And I'm Sophia Hagelani-Alba. This month, we are really excited for the conversation we're about to have.
Yes, this month we are being joined by another fellow researcher at University of Helsinki, although from a different discipline. This researcher is a dear friend of mine. We've been friends for almost 8 years when we both studied at King's College London together. So without further ado, Miriam, welcome to the show. Would you introduce yourself for our audience?
Thank you so much. It is obviously lovely to be here, and it's great to be part of this podcast. I can't say I've listened to all of the episodes, but I've really enjoyed the ones that I've heard so far. So it's great to be here so I can discuss my own research with you guys. The challenging task of introducing myself. My name is Miriam Hauer, and I am researching political economy at the University of Helsinki. My research is focused on essentially providing a Marxist analysis of Islamic economic philosophy. It's quite a mouthful, but essentially what I'm trying to do is look at Islamic economic philosophy, Islamic economics itself, and try to fill in some of the gaps in the theoretical material that is available for academics or general population within that discipline. The Marxist bit comes from the fact that I work within the Marxist political economy school of thought. And when I go exploring in Islamic economic philosophy for these theoretical gaps and these questions that I have about these gaps, when I try to answer these questions, I use the framework of Marxist political economy. Of course, I am trying to work in a very interdisciplinary space. So I do take expertise from feminist political economy, feminist economics, and as of today, I had been taking a lot from feminism in Islam, Islamic theology, and Islamic philosophy. So there are a lot of things happening in my research. So there are a lot of things happening in my head usually. And I try to bring all of these interdisciplinary insights to essentially answer 3 to 4 questions that I've had for a few years now. And as Chris has already mentioned, we've known each other for 8 years. And I basically got interested in Islamic economic philosophy at King's College. My master's thesis was about providing an analysis of Islamic banks in the financial crisis of 2007. It was a very interesting insight into the discipline. I had previously no knowledge of Islamic banking or even Islamic economics. So it was an entirely new area for me to explore. That sort of led me to read more about it. And I realized that coming from the Marxist school of thought, there was a lot of rich tradition in Marxism, in Marxist political economy, and related perspectives of Marxism in different other disciplines. So that provided me with a lot of information on different issues within economics. But when I tried to read about Islamic economic philosophy, I realized that these different aspects that I think are very important, they are not being answered in this particular school of thought. And I thought it would be interesting for me to go about answering these questions. As a young postgrad, I fancied myself a theorist / philosopher. So, you know, I thought if Plato could do it, surely I can also. I have the internet. And that's how I got here, with a hopeful naivete and, glorious ambition. And hopefully it will not be the end of me.
I definitely don't think it will be the end of you. That's really interesting. This is a topic that I didn't really ever think of as existing. I mean, of course, it sounds like it's very rich, and there's a lot of different avenues to explore with it, especially bringing the political economy together with feminist theory and the Islamic banking. Like, wow, I'm really excited to hear more about what exactly you've researched and how you came to it. So just out of curiosity, I know that you and Christopher said that you met in King's College in London. And what brought you to University of Helsinki?
Well, after I graduated from King's, I sort of took a little bit of a break to have some personal journeys and sort of get some teaching experience. But during that, I was looking for a place to do my PhD. And when I say I looked everywhere, except for the US. I want the record to state that I did not try to go to the US for my PhD, just for the record. I looked at different places, and my aim was to find a university with a particular set of qualities in the department, you know, which is basically independence in my research, a more fluid approach to which departments I have access to, and also sort of a supervisor who'd be more open-minded about what I pursue in my own research and let me do it on my own pace and in my own structure, within my own structure. So I tried to find different universities in Europe. Sometimes I would find the supervisor that I could work with, but then I wouldn't, you know, be able to sort of get a department where my research would be accepted by the whole department. Sometimes there was a problem with getting access to funding resources, which was specifically a problem with universities in the UK, as I'm not a European passport holder. But then I found the University of Helsinki, and I actually found it through Chris, because I realized that Chris has joined the PhD program here. And I thought, you know what, I do trust my own research, but clearly Chris thinks this is a good university. If he thinks that, it's probably good. So the fact that Chris was studying here was a major, you know, take on my checklist. So I got in touch with the supervisors here that I potentially could work with, and it was great. I had very interesting conversations, and I had always wanted to sort of try living in, you know, the north, the real north, if I can say so without offending Icelandic people. But yeah, I always wanted to do that. So it just seemed that everything came together. And so far I've been very happy with the supervision that I've gotten. The fact that I can go to different departments, like I said, because my research requires expertise from different disciplines, and disciplines that I have absolutely no idea of. Like, I was a novice in philosophy and theology, and Islamic feminism really just hit me in the face like a ton of bricks. But when I came here, I was able to get access to different courses, and almost all the professors that I have tried to get in touch with here, they've been so open to give me time and provide me direction so that I could actually learn more in order to, you know, work on my research. So I think that had been a great choice.
Well, I mean, I'm super glad to have you here. I mean, I remember when he reached out to me about it, I was super happy like that you did. And I mean, you know, absolutely brilliant. I mean, university's lucky to have you. You know, it's out of the fact that I'm here, I'm surprised that didn't scare you away. But I mean, I'm very glad that you are here. But getting to the heart of things, so I guess for our listeners, for us, what makes Islamic finance or Islamic banking unique? I mean, you sent us some materials which were really interesting to read. And, you know, for me, I had like a little bit of experience here and there, like just knew some very vague things, you know, from my time in Saudi Arabia and stuff like that. But I know for a lot of people, they're not even aware that there is another type of finance or banking other than the neoliberal model that, you know, surrounds us everywhere.
That is an excellent question. And I think this really gives me a great way to sort of open up the discussion about my own research. The key point of my research has always been that I don't research finance or banking, because at this point, I think I would like to make this distinction between Islamic economics and Islamic finance or banking. Of course, Islamic banking has created a niche for itself since the first Islamic banks were created in Saudi Arabia and UAE in the 70s and 80s. So it's definitely a particular style of banking that exists. It's quite successful, and it has gone through crises, and it has still survived. So, of course, it is a legitimate form of banking that exists. Now, how different it is from neoliberal capitalist banking and how similar it is to it is really a subjective opinion. And working from the Marxist school of thought, I would not be eager to give positive marks to any sort of commercial banking. But just to focus our conversation on what I actually research, which is Islamic economics. So essentially, the difference being that, and this difference is actually one of my issues with research in Islamic economics, that most of the academic attention goes to developing financial products and banking practices that can be profitable in the context of global capitalist banking. And of course, there's a lot of financial backing for that, and there are careers to be made, which I don't resent anyone. However, because of this, there is a lot of room in Islamic economics, which is not explored, essentially the philosophy of economics. And we know that economics itself is, you know, a development of philosophical engagement. So the philosophy of any economic perspective has to be very solid if we are to develop anything on that. Now, what I do is work on that economic philosophy into different philosophical perspectives that can assist in developing perhaps also banking and financial products, perhaps labor unions within Islamic economics or other questions. But really, my job is to work on things in the ground, like the basement, the foundational floor, what I think should be of any economic practice. So I think that distinction is very important, because I wouldn't want this conversation to sort of be more about banking and finance, because my research is not about banking and finance. And it's unfortunate that what people do know about Islamic economics is about Islamic banking, the fact that there should be no interest, and, you know, the profit sharing principles of Islamic banking. But there is a lot more, much more interesting material, I feel, that can be found in Islamic economic thinking.
So you said that your research isn't about the banking and finance. And earlier you mentioned that there are some questions that you've come to in your research. Would this be a good time to give us some insight into your niche of this larger field?
Yes, actually, this would be a very good segue into that. So one of the questions that I've been working on mostly for the last 2 years is the notion of economic agent. Now, we know that orthodox economics has a lot of ideas about economic agent or the economic man, so to speak, and how the economic man interacts with the larger economy. In Islamic economic philosophy, there are notions of, you know, the man or the person who is going around interacting with the economy, with businesses, and with the larger society. But there is no satisfactory economic man, for lack of a better term, as exists in the orthodox economic understanding. Now, when I started reading about that, my idea was to develop a skeleton, at least, of the economic man in Islamic economics. But as I continued to read about it more, I realized that the sources where I'm looking for this economic man, the ethics literature or the genre of ethics in Islamic philosophy, for example, that literature, those sources that I've been looking at, they are rather, they are rather sexist, for lack of a better term, or I should say more that they are sort of gender blind, and not just gender blind, but also sort of class blind. Now, we can get into debates on why that is the case, but without getting into that digression, so when I discovered that there is a gender and class blindness in the sources that I am looking for my economic person in, I realized that I had to do more research. I went to sources in Islamic feminism, and I tried to read works by different feminists and also scholars who don't call themselves feminists in Islamic theology and in general in Islamic ethics literature as well. So when I started reading that and sort of developing my research more, I have come into a place where I am trying to not just develop a theory of the economic agent, but also a gender and class sensitive theory of economic agency. So in a way, my question has evolved from the last 2 years based on, I don't know, writers usually say that they don't write texts, they receive them. I don't know if that also applies to academic research, because I'm probably receiving it. So if that gives you a context of not just what I research, but how I sort of, how I do the researching and how I arrive at my theorizing. So hopefully it sort of answers your question in a more abstract way.
Absolutely. Thank you. So, I mean, scratching a bit more at this, I mean, I'm sure that this is a very long and deep topic, but I mean, again, for us, for our listeners, can you give us some examples of this, like gender blindness and class blindness, and maybe how you work around that, or like what you've been finding to be able to put and expand that view to get past those blind spots?
That's a very, very good question. It's an incredible question. An example of that would be one of the ethicists that I explore to find out, you know, agency and how the economic man, if you will, would work in the society from the perspective of Islamic philosophy or Islamic ethics is Al-Ghazali, a very famous individual across the board. And I'm sure many of the listeners would have heard about him or read about him. So I approach one or two of the texts that Ghazali has written. In these texts, Al-Ghazali sort of discusses the idea of you know, public and personal ethics and how an individual is supposed to go about their daily life in a way that works for the society and sort of reflects the microcosm, macrocosm debate in philosophy, where the human being is supposed to be a reflection of the entire universe, to put it very simply. So he's discussing in these texts how the citizen goes about their daily life, how they engage in trade, how they engage with their communities, their families, so on and so forth. And within these prescriptions, we find, for example, like I said, the idea of engaging with trade. This provides me with an insight on how the economic agent is supposed to be or supposed to exist within the Islamic philosophical perspective. However, writing in his time, Ghazali does not speak about women, because from where he is writing from, women are supposed to be performing their ethics within the household. They are achieving ethical refinement or enlightenment within the household, not in the public sphere where the trade is. That's a sphere where the man, the male citizen, is supposed to sort of express his ethical self. So that gives us sort of a gender dichotomy in the role of the woman or the role of the man, which means that most of the ideas that are relevant for economic thinking, they are sort of, you know, discussed from the perspectives of men. And not just men, but a particular class of men. When Ghazali is speaking about, you know, the citizen who engages with the city and with the rulers and with everyone else in the community, there is a very clear distinction that comes across when we read about it, because this person, the citizen that Ghazali is referring to constantly, is not your working class laborer. It is clear that this citizen has privileges where they are able to have access to the ruling class and establish households. They have property. They engage in literary and political discussions. And if we historicize the texts that are written, these texts written by Al-Ghazali, we can see that there is a large portion of people which are missing from these discussions. They would be the peasants, for example. And we also know that women, being relegated to the household was something of a privileged space, even in that time, because a lot of women used to work in the fields. A lot of women used to provide domestic services. So these women are just not part of the conversation, which also points to the class blindness in these texts. Now, of course, that being said, these texts still provide a lot for me or for anybody interested in these questions or in ethics in general. But of course, for my purposes, that requires me to sort of engage with different perspectives on the same text. So there is a writer, Zahra Ayoubi, who has a very good book about ethicists and how they've sort of missed the notion of gender and class. But of course, she's not talking about economics. She's talking about other spheres where ethics are to be performed. So it's scholars like Zahra Ayoubi that I reach out to for these questions, because then their work provides me an insight into, a critical insight, I should say, into Ghazali's work without being sort of, you know, colonial or orientalist. So people who work from within the tradition of the Islamic school of thought in various disciplines, they provide an insight for me to sort of further explore and develop my own theories.
Thank you so much for unpacking that a bit. I do have one question, though, that is maybe perhaps a bit simplistic, but I just want to clarify before we continue on. Are we talking more about maybe the theoretical aspect of these systems, or are we talking about banking systems that are actually in play in practice on the ground?
That is actually a very good question. And I have been asked this question before in a more revolutionary setting. For example, the same question I was asked when I was presenting this chapter to a sort of a feminist research panel. And they asked me in different words whether I'm trying to change any of the institutions or whether I'm presenting solutions to powerful bodies which make rules and legislations around Islamic economics, specifically banking. So this is a pertinent question to ask. However, I am not. What I'm trying to do is really ground level work. So just keeping with the example of economic agency, when I try to sort of discuss ethicists in Islam and the existing literature and engage with, again, feminists working within Islamic tradition or outside it, when I bring that to the fore, when I try to write about it, my intention is, of course, as a Marxist-leaning academic, if I can call myself an academic already, my intention is always very revolutionary. I want to bring down the machine. I want to emancipate and liberate, you know, all of that. But that's just a fantasy. In real time, what this research can do is be legitimate, be acceptable, and provide a new critical insight to economic agency, particularly the economic agency of working class women who exist right now, and working class women who have existed since the beginning of time. What I'm trying to do here is sort of create space within theories for these individuals, these intersections of class and gender. And perhaps in 80 years, another researcher would be working on, you know, Islamic banking, and they would maybe find someone who referred to someone who might have read my dissertation sometime. And maybe that individual in 80 years would be able to sort of do something that would change some institution somewhere. And I know that doesn't sound very optimistic, and that doesn't sound like something that would, you know, get the blood hot, but that is the nature of academic research. That's the nature of theorizing. So I do have revolutionary ambitions and dreams, but I am very content if I can just be, you know, one of the threads in the revolutionary tapestry of emancipation 200 years from now.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's, yeah, Very, very fair. I mean, especially, you got to build those theoretical foundations if you are going to be building up into empirical stuff. And, it's also a great basis for, postdocs and things like that. We got to keep our eyes on the future. Can't give them everything all at once. We got to keep getting paid in this neoliberal system. But so I guess, like, with all of this, and I'm curious, I mean, since there has been this, like, miss on gender and class, like, as you mentioned, you've been looking at a lot of feminist works, Islamic feminist works. So how have you been able to, I guess, create this space that you mentioned, especially when you're looking at these authors from the past that are talking about different, perhaps, time periods or things like that? How have you been able to carve out that space in something that's, been written there already, I guess?
I think it's more about the process of research for me personally. And I'm sure it's different for everyone else. I never pursued my PhD or any research I've ever done for even the smallest essays as sort of finding a space. I've always just read something and I have questions, then I try to look for the answer. If I find the answer, it's great. I know the answer now to my own questions. But if I don't find the answer, then I would like to explore the answer myself and, make up the answer perhaps. That's how I ended up doing my thesis for my master's as well. And that is how I've sort of arrived at this PhD thesis as well. So, essentially, I wasn't really looking for my niche because I didn't, to be honest, I didn't know that I would be thinking about Islamic feminism or feminism and Islam or, the feminist interpretations of Al-Ghazali's work. I never thought I would be doing that, but I tend to give myself to the rabbit hole of research. Once I started reading about one thing that led me to the other, which led me to another, which led me to this professor in this department, which led me to this book, which led me to this course. And it's just this vague, abstract process that I go through, which is also why I have been so slow with the process of writing that actually gets my PhD done, because I enjoy the exercise of thinking and reading and just imagining that so much, that eventually anyone following that process would arrive at a space where there is an empty spot, where all these intersections meet and there is a gap, and you can try to fill that gap. And I think that's how research is supposed to be done. That's how I've always thought about research. And I guess when you have to get paid and when you have to get funding, this might not be very attractive. But in the purest sense, I think that's how research works. And that's how I arrived in this place. I don't know if I would be able to answer the question, which is, be able to theorize in a class or gender sensitive economic agent. But I know I will produce something. And that's what keeps me going. Something will come out of this.
You just said something that spoke to me on like a soul level, which is I hope my research does something because, I feel exactly the same way. Like I hope I produce something out of it. I don't have any brilliant question to come out of that, but I just wanted to reflect that that sentiment like really resonated strongly with me.
Yeah, and I hope that's not a defeatist sentiment for a listener because truth be told, with the process of research, the thing is that we have, of course, established higher standards, and we all judge ourselves so much that we want to produce a physical, achievable object or an actual theory which satisfies the standards of what constitutes a theory. But to be honest, if I can say anything about all the material that I've read, the fact that I can now say that, look at Islamic economics, there is no gender or class sensitivity in the concept of economic agency. lo and behold, the entire notion of economic agent is non-existent or barely exists. I think practically, to be fair, that should be my contribution to the academy. Like that is it. That is my contribution to the discipline of Islamic economic philosophy. I will take your thanks in writing. Thank you. But it's just not that case. That's not enough. I understand that, and I'm willing to work on it to produce something. But I am also cognizant of the fact that even if I do not develop an actual economic agent, which sort of reflects all my ambitions and satisfies all the requirements of a legitimate theory, I am happy to just touch on that, just produce a written paper on it. So maybe someone down the line in 10 years can find it, and it might help them to create something. And I think it's very important as academics to sort of keep that in mind while we do our work.
I wholeheartedly agree. And the work around data extractivism and things like that, trying to just make it a field, or not even necessarily a field, just an idea that people think of. I had plenty of people come and be like, well, what about all these things? And it's like, I'm not saying I have all the answers. I'm saying that I'm laying this stuff out so that other people can be like, oh, hey, and then could bring in things that I'm not even capable of thinking of. So I don't have the perspectives. I don't have necessarily that knowledge. But it's, you know, that's what helps me go to sleep at night, is the knowledge that hopefully somebody will pay attention to this and find it useful. But with all of this, you know, it's one of the reasons we're so happy to have you on here is, of course, you know, we are the Extractivisms and Alternatives podcast. And we do kind of lean into the extractivisms perhaps a bit more, but, you know, especially what you're looking at with Islamic economic philosophy and bringing in these voices which have not been so loud or not had space for them. How does this perhaps differ from or push back against this dominant Western neoliberal economic philosophy that we see so much in the world today?
Well, that question sort of leads me to really emphasize on the spirit of my research, my personal motivation, so to speak. So when I try to write about my work, now at this point, I think it's important to note that my own academic background is predominantly British, even though I was born in the Global South and I grew up in the Global South as well. But most of my education has been, you know, British curriculum and then King's College in here. So I'm not perhaps the person to speak for the Global South, truth be told. However, when I do my research, I try to engage different schools of thought or different disciplines. For example, I work from the Marxist political economy perspective, and that is very clearly a Western or a perspective of the global North. It's Western philosophy. So when I say that I'm trying to fill in the gaps of Islamic economic philosophy with the help of Marxism, it sort of is an ironic statement, because what I'm trying to do is bring a non-European perspective of economics to the table, sort of highlight that, sort of, you know, voice that perspective. But then I'm using Marxism for it. So, you know, it's ironic, and I acknowledge that as much as possible. But the difference here is that I try to engage Marxist economic thought, Marxist political economy, with Islamic economic philosophy. So neither one is trying to oppress the other, in a manner of speaking, when I write about it. And the other side being creating a narrative that is different from the orthodoxy. And this also leads back to the earlier question about what's the difference between Orthodox banks and Islamic banks. And both of these questions, both of these ideas are very interlinked, because the truth is that with being integrated in the neoliberal capitalist global system, Islamic banks to a great extent have over time started becoming similar to conventional banking, because what do you need to survive is profit. And how do you make a profit in this global economy? It's by being integrated into it. And then it's the same thing that happens with ideas as well. So how do you you know, increase your value in the marketplace of ideas by aligning yourself as much as possible with the dominant ideologies, which is, hurts my soul to say, neoliberalism. So even when we think about, or even when I try to think about, you know, Islamic economics, I have to struggle within literature in this discipline that is constantly trying to assimilate patterns of neoliberalism. So what I'm trying to do is push back against it and sort of trying to highlight the marginalized voice, not just in economics or political economy, but also within Islamic economics. Within the discipline, there's a strong mindset amongst a lot of academics that Islamic economics is not socialism. It's pro-private property, it's pro-free trade, it's pro-economic prosperity. And I personally wouldn't disagree with that as much, but it's important to highlight the pro-commons, the pro-common property voices in Islamic economic philosophy, the ethics which assert the importance of egalitarianism, and the ethics of, you know, commons. So it's important to push back not just against Eurocentrism in the traditional sense of the word, but also against the Eurocentrism that is now found in a lot of thinking in the global South as well. So really, there's a lot of pushing back in my research. Hopefully some of it works.
Thank you so much for sharing about some of those like tensions and pushbacks. And I think it's really interesting, but not to completely derail the conversation or put on the brakes, but I remember earlier you mentioned that there are three or four different questions that you're looking at in your research. And I have to admit, I'm wondering, what are some of those other questions?
That's a very good question, considering that we've sort of touched on this before. So essentially, like I said before, my dissertation will talk about two or three different or four problems based on how many problems I can deal with in the next 2 years. But my aim is to not just talk about the economic agent, but the other question that I would try like to explore is based on, you know, interests. So we know that Islamic banks, Islamic economics, Islam theologically frowns upon interest or usury. That's just an accepted paradigm. And that was an accepted paradigm in most Abrahamic traditions before the advent of interest-based banking. What I'm interested in is, from a theoretical perspective, what is this prohibition based on? Is it based on uneven class relations? For example, we know that interest allows people to make money from money. So is this prohibition on interest because of that? And if it is based on class relations, is it based on wealth inequality or income inequality? How does the discussion of inequality fit into this narrative? This is definitely one of the questions that I would like to explore. This is a whole discussion we can have, of course. Another question that I'm very interested in is the concept of exploitation. And this really takes me back more to my sort of Marxist roots, exploitation of labor, and, you know, basically the stealing from labor is a key paradigm within Marxist thought. I would really like to explore its space in Islamic economics. I can say that so far I've found that exploitation, as we understand what we understand when I say exploitation, that word does not translate into another similar concept in Islamic economic literature so far that I have read. But then there are discussions around the fact that interest rate is prohibited because it is exploitative. And that's something that I find interesting. If interest rate is exploitative, if interest in itself is exploitation, then what is exploitation? How is it exploitation? You know, it's a very abstract concept, but it fascinates me. And of course, there are practical uses to have. For example, with the interest rate question that I posed, is interest based on uneven class relations? A better understanding of why interest is based beyond the fact that the Abrahamic God prohibits it, which of course is a valid reason to stay away from it for the more religiously inclined population of the world. But theoretically speaking, a better understanding of whether interest rate interest itself is based on uneven class relations will sort of help us, or help banking and finance, to sort of really build themselves in order to sort of be more aligned to the ethics of, you know, prohibiting interest. On the other hand, thinking about exploitation in Islamic economics will sort of allow us to use that concept more as a legislative measure, for example, in Islamic jurisprudence, or in countries where states are inclined to include some elements of Islamic thinking into their legislature. A theory of exploitation will sort of help remove some of the ambiguity behind not just interest rate, but also many other practices that can be considered exploitative.
Thank you so much for that. I mean, really fascinating questions. And, you know, to dig in a little bit, starting from the first one, it's such an interesting idea of usury and like class inequality and wealth inequality. So I'm curious, with all this, bringing this in this lens, like, did this purely come from like the Marxist analysis, or do you think people had this kind of in the back of their heads when they were, you know, coming up with these systems, or something totally different?
Well, it's interesting to sort of think about class and wealth inequalities or income inequalities, and the nature of these discussions that might be taking place across the history of Islamic thinking. What we need to keep in mind at this point is, firstly, in the 7th century, Arabia, in that particular region where Islam was sort of conceptualized as a faith, the society was a lot different from how we understand. And then for the Marxist thinking, where we really started thinking about class and class politics, the post-industrial European society was very different from the 7th century Arabian society, and also very different from the 21st century European society itself. So when we think about class differences and inequalities, I am trying not to be anachronistic. I'm trying not to project contemporary ideas to the past. With that in mind, these conversations on inequality are very fascinating. And I would like to name drop David Graeber and David Van Groh's latest text on the history of, I think it's called A History of Everything. Something like that. Don't judge me by not knowing the name of the book. But it poses some very interesting questions about the concept of inequality, or how we came to discuss inequality. And inequality as a phenomena is discussed in the Quran. And it is, because it is discussed in the Quran, which is the primary founding text of Islam, because inequality is discussed in the Quran, it has been taken up by Islamic economic thinkers. The fascinating aspect is that the inequality that the Quran discusses, and that's something that I've been thinking since like 8 a.m. this morning specifically, the inequality that the Quran discusses is a lot different from the inequality that I think about when I say inequality. And it's important to sort of draw the lineage, so to speak, of inequality from that time to my present time. For instance, I just read a news article on Politico I think, yeah, it was definitely on Politico, which was talking about windfall profits for oil corporations in Europe and UK. Magnanimous profits, you know, just ridiculous amounts of money due to the fact that there is a war in Europe. And yeah, basically all companies have been able to enjoy a lot of profits because of that. And while these people and their shareholders are making millions, we know that people in Europe are facing a lot of poverty, especially energy poverty. Things that we have sort of been thinking about, even in countries as wealthy as the Scandinavian region, the Nordic region. So when we think about, when I think about inequality, the inequality that enrages me at my morning oatmeal, you know, this is the inequality that I talk about. This is not the inequality that the Quran conceptualizes. So therefore, when early, when classic, classical scholars of Islam, when they talk about inequality, they are not talking about this ridiculous inequality that translates into global political power. So the inequality or the wealth, the wealth inequality that we have between, say, the University of Helsinki and Shell, the petroleum company, that wealth inequality, even just between institutions, translates into different political power. Shell can, I don't know, they can do whatever their imagination so inclines them to do. But that's not the thing that is possible for the University of Helsinki, for example. And by giving the University of Helsinki, I'm trying to you know, show you a sort of a polarity between a university, a large university in a wealthy global North country. So even in that situation, there is so much difference in political power based on wealth inequality between two institutions that allows us to see the difference in political power that wealth inequality creates between individuals in same countries and even more so on a global level. So these discussions on inequality have to be introduced to the discussion of inequality from a religious perspective. For the Quran, inequality is created by God. Of course, he has made some people more capable than others. And as someone who was raised in the confessional circle of Islam, that is a beautiful thing to hear. You know, of course, God creates some people better than the others. But when I've been told that, I just imagine the fact that my brother is really good at playing football and I can't throw a ball to save my life. That is the inequality that I think about. I think about the fact that, you know, I think about juvenile things. I think about ridiculous things when I think about this inequality. I do not think about the fact that I do not believe that the Quran meant that God creates some people to be so wealthy they can control elections and democracy in your country, while some people have to sleep in the cold outside without homes. I do not believe that's the inequality the Quran has referred to. And I think it's very important to sort of engage with this conversation head on within the discipline of Islamic economic philosophy if we are to have real answers to real problems in the world. And I don't mean to be too critical, but also I do. So if the discipline of Islamic economics wants to say that this is an alternative to orthodox economic thinking, or that this is the answer to capitalism and socialism as the form of economic organization, then they have to answer these very real questions. They have to answer these fundamental questions. So inequality and the inequality of wealth, the inequality of income is a larger conversation. And I'm hoping to sort of scratch the surface of it when I talk about it in my own thesis.
Your morning oatmeal thoughts are much more profound than my morning oatmeal thoughts. I think that this is a really interesting unpacking of, you know, that inequality and how it plays out in this particular sense. And I really appreciate, you know, what you brought up in institutional inequality, even because I think that, you know, it's really easy to think like, oh, big institutions, like any big institution can do anything. But I think that, you know, even thinking about a very powerful institution against some of the other actors in the world, it's almost insignificant, you know, it's crazy. Like these, like the fossil fuel companies and some of these other private enterprises that just hold so much power simply by the fact that they just have so much economic wealth. And one of those things, I know that this is a little bit simplistic, but I saw a tweet, you know, really deep stuff happening here that was talking about how much bigger a billion is than a million. That like a million seconds is about 11 days, but a billion seconds is about 31.5 years. So like pull that then into the economic sphere. And, you know, even if you have hundreds of millions of dollars or euros or other forms of currency at your disposal, that's still like nothing in the face of hundreds of billions.
Yeah, and I think it's very important to sort of contextualize that. And on the opposite spectrum, I would say, especially sort of talking about inequality, and all of a sudden, all the texts that I've read are coming back to me today. But there's this inequality text about Branko Milanović, which is a classical text, and it talks about inequality between people of different countries, which I absolutely love. So I come from a family of migrants. You know, when European right-wingers say that they're coming to take over, they're talking about my family. Like they're everywhere except for the country where we're supposed to be technically. So coming from such a family, I can tell you that there are differences in political power between me and my cousins in different countries. So I have an aunt in Switzerland and I live here. So our political power, the access we have to reproductive rights, to thinking about our reproductive rights, to healthcare, to raising our children, to job security, to pensions, is different based on where we live. And then the opportunities I have in, you know, vis-a-vis my cousins living in, say, Pakistan or my cousins living in UAE, are so strikingly different, so strikingly different. So I think we need to think about inequalities in different ways. We really need to personalize inequality, the inequality in political power between me and my cousin. Now, I'm not a wealthy person. I have little to no savings. And we think that, you know, we tend to think that students are poor, even though we get funded. Academics are not exactly the richest people out there. But then in comparison to my cousins in the global South, I am loaded. I am so privileged. I am so wealthy. And these stark differences in same tribes, in the same clans, sort of foster alienation between communities. And they also foster a sort of an antagonism of identity. They sort of make us, for example, they make me and my cousin want to be on different poles. It kills class solidarity because at the end of the day, I'm a working class woman. She's a working class woman. And we need to be, you know, we need to be on the same page on that front. But because of this inequality based on where we live, she would never be able to see that I am one of her. And I might not be able to see that she is one of me, you know, as a woman, as a tribe. So I think in an increasingly global world where people are migrating constantly, I think for those who are more, you know, I don't want to say socialist, but like community minded or people who think there should be agency within communities, I think this is a problem. And this will only become a larger problem as we go forward in history.
Absolutely. And I think it's such an interesting point to unpack these different types and ways that inequalities play out. I mean, when you were describing how inequality is discussed in the Quran, and like in my head, it's like, yeah, not everyone's made just from a cookie cutter mold. Like we all have different skills. We all have different value in different ways. And that's a good thing. Or I mean, you know, I think of that as a good thing, you know, But also, like, you know, my mind kind of leaps to how these sorts of ideas have been perverted in a Western context, thinking of divine right to rule, like, you know, God, you know, God made us so that we were meant to rule, or like the whole quote unquote development project coming out of the colonial project of, yes, you know, we're here because God put us here to help everyone else in the world, because, you know, we're fortunate in this and we have to do it for everyone else's sake. So, I mean, I find that really interesting. And I guess a question of this is, do you see a similar sort of, perversion happening around Islamic economics? Has this been used to justify the wealth of, you know, not to point fingers, but maybe some royal families in certain countries or something like that?
This is a pertinent question, and it's also pertinent because it makes me think about all the reading that I still need to do. I would say that this question allows me to basically highlight the fact that divine rule is quite different as a concept between Christianity and Islam. So in Islamic theology, no one is meant to rule anyone in that way. A king is not a representative of God. Rather, there's a very interesting principle, the principle of khilafa, who is a khalifa. And of course, a very loaded term in the context of Western audience. But the principle of khilafa is that the human being is supposed to be a representative of God on earth. A very interesting conversation that a theologist, Islamic theologist, Amina Wadud, has is about the concept of the wahdaniyat of God, or, you know, the singularity where God is the most powerful and everyone else is beneath God. So there is no hierarchy where there is a king. Of course, prophets are above human beings and saints are above mere mortals. But the idea is that God is one, which is translated as tawhid, which means oneness. And if God is one and he is above everything else, then all creatures are beneath him. So I don't believe, and I have not come across anyone justifying the rule of a royal family based on the Quranic notion of inequality or divine rule. Of course, we're familiar with the individuals posing themselves as khalifas of the Islamic community or the Islamic Ummah. But we do understand that these are political positions, and a khalifa in the real sense of Islamic politics, or, you know, the classical sense of politics, is supposed to be elected by a council of people. So really, there is no notion of a divine right to rule in Islamic theology, none that I have read so far, which is another interesting fact to think about. It is possible that no one has had to yet do that, because the example, as you gave, of colonial sort of propaganda, I would say, the colonizing mindset, where I don't know what the personal thinking was of a colonizer to justify that, oh, I'm here to teach you better because God made me better than you and I should be ruling you. It speaks to a very particular flavor of virtue signaling in history. It was so unnecessary. You have all the guns and the might. You really don't need to explain yourself. But just like that, I think the contemporary ruling families that we have in Muslim majority countries, I think they have not had the need to sort of emphasize their divine right to rule in the light of the Quran, because they haven't really tried to colonize any place very visibly where they go and they say, oh, we're here, we're better than you. Maybe if there was enough political initiative to do that, I'm sure you could pay someone to make that argument for you. But I think that has not been necessary. Of course, historically, we can see that, the the Khilafah has been a debated concept and different people have had different opinions about it, but none so about royal families or ruling families, in my knowledge, at least.
Thank you so much for that. It's so, so fascinating and a lot to really think about and unpack there. But unfortunately, we've been taking a lot of your time on this, I guess, warm and gray Finnish winter afternoon, above zero. So we should probably go towards something.
What?
I think you know.
Do I know?
Well, I mean, I hope by this point you do.
Oh, God, is this that thing that we do?
Every month.
Take over the world?
Fortunately and unfortunately, no.
Are we going to ask
the question? Question time. So every episode we like to wrap up by asking our guests the question. It's a call to action for our listeners. Everyone's listening. They're fascinated. They want to learn more. They want to do something. They want to dig in. So, Miriam, is there something you can recommend for our listeners to do or read or think about to bring this conversation into their lives?
Well, I am almost faith-bound to ask people to once again read The Capital if they have not yet, which is really, it's a call of the times, to be honest. You should be doing that. Of course, I've already, I think, pointed out some great texts. But I would also say that, in these times, especially not just in crisis times, but also in times where our world has been changing so much. In my lifespan, it has been changing so much. Not just crisis after crisis, but we've seen, great things happen one after the other. So in times like this, I think it's important to explore different ideas. And I think people should not be afraid of that. Pick up any philosophers other than Nietzsche, I have to say that. Just pick up a philosopher, pick up a poet, pick up an artist that you can, listen to or read about. Really just think about things that you were not told to think about, which is why I say read something other than Nietzsche. And really just explore spaces outside your own individual circles. And by that, I mean, really, if you're in Europe, then try to think about thinking in, maybe some country in the global south, because honestly, that's where the change comes from. And we've just been locked into constantly regurgitating the past over and over. And I think it's important for everyone to break that impasse. And lastly, just so me and myself and people like me can continue getting funding, please read about religious ideologies in a context which is different from, violence or oppression. Because I think a lot of really brilliant ideas are lost because of, because of our lenience or our perception of what some ideology or some idea might tell us. So yeah, just be open-minded and go somewhere you didn't expect to go.
That is an absolutely phenomenal answer to the question. So you heard it here first, folks. Be open-minded, explore, don't be afraid. I really appreciate that you have highlighted this for our listeners, because I think that it is something that's really important. Pick up something unexpected, bring something unexpected into the work that you're doing. And I think sometimes, especially for those of us in the academic milieu, it does sometimes get a bit, repeating the same over and over. So I know that I hear this as a call to action and something that I want to make sure to stay cognizant of in my day-to-day academic explorations.
Yes, thank you so much. It was absolutely beautiful and such an important thing. I mean, Today you're expanding our paths in academically and in life. Even though, I'm in a field where I've been looking at a lot of different contexts of the global South, everywhere's got something always new and amazing and beautiful to find. And yeah, thank you so much for highlighting that and for coming on and having such a wonderful conversation with us.
Thank you so much for having me here. It's been a great way to spend my afternoon and, of course, a wonderful way to sort of recap my own research in my mind and, really get to think about my ideas. So thank you so much.
A huge thank you again to Miriam Power for coming on and having such a wonderful and enriching conversation with us. Please join us next month when we're going to be talking with Patience Masusa about life, challenge, and change in the Zambian Copper Belt. From the cold rain, then ice, then rain again of Helsinki, Finland, I am Christopher Shagnon. On behalf of Sophia Hagelani-Albov, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.